Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a special episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. Today's episode, we won't be having reviews per se. However, Rafi, the senior writer at The Film Stage, went to the Cannes Film Festival, and he will be giving us his rundown of the best and worst of the fest, and we'll just be following up, asking about what he thought of some of the awards, and also checking in to see which of the top three that Nick and Danny and I named ended up on the good list. So, Rafi, welcome.
Hello. How are you, Brian?
I am doing fantastic. It is a pretty nice Memorial Day.
Yes, I'm enjoying it myself. I'm using the day to kind of catch up from the time difference from being in France for the last 10 days.
That's got to be some good synchronicity that you kind of have the day off to...
Luckily I have the day off, so I was able to catch up a little bit on sleep and kind of catch back up in the time zone, so I'm doing good.
Not that you would get a lot of sympathy even if you weren't doing well, because
right.
You got to go to Cannes.
That's true. True. Getting a lot of jealous fans. No, just humble bragging. This is my third year in a row, fourth year in total of going to the fest. And, you know, it's a really special fest for me. I love going to it every year. And I always end up seeing like a majority of the films I consider the best films of the year at this festival. So I try to make it a priority to go.
You were a lucky man.
Yes, I save up to go, and the film stage pays part of the way. So, God bless you, Jordan.
It's a shout out to Jordan Raup, who was actually on the last episode we recorded about Francis Ha.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, let's.
I have not seen that yet. So
it's. I didn't like it. Jordan and Nick liked it, but I was not a fan.
I've heard mostly good things, so you might be in the...
I am in the extreme minority from what I've seen.
Yeah.
In that I thought the character of Francis was insufferable.
Gotcha.
But not here to talk about that again. Let's let that wound heal up.
Problem.
So we're going to start off with your personal top five of the fest, and then we're going to segue into what you thought were some of the more lacking pictures.
Sure.
And then we'll clean it all up by just letting me shoot some titles at you and letting us hear your opinion.
Sounds good.
All right. So why don't you kick us off?
So just to give you a brief overview, I saw 25 films over the festival, reviewed 20 of them. So they're all up there on the film stage. Let's talk about the best films, the films that left the best impression with me. My number five, I would say, is probably The Congress, which is Ari Folman's follow-up to Waltz with Bashir. I don't know if you're familiar with that film or not.
I am indeed.
Okay. It's a very kind of trippy, bizarre, surreal film. It kind of is a little bit Being John Malkovich, a little bit of Richard Linklater's Scanner Darkly, and it's a mix of live action and animation. And, it's a film that... is really pushing the boundaries of what like a really creative visionary can do with the medium. And it's sloppy in some places, but I really just, this film stuck with me from the minute I saw it. And I really dug the animation style. That's part of another big reason I enjoyed it. And if you're not on board with animation, it might be a little bit hard to get on board with it. It's kind of got a trippy, surreal vibe where it's a little bit like Waking Life, that kind of rotoscope of real life, but very abstract. And it's big ideas. It's based on a story by Stanislaw Lem, who wrote Solaris. And I really dug it. I don't know if you've seen the trailer. We have the trailer on the website. And it stars Robin Wright Penn. But that played in the director's fortnight, which is not in the main competition. So that's one of the subcategories of the festival. But I made a point to go see it because I'm such a fan of Waltz with Bashir. So, yeah.
Well, that sounds incredible. And I personally haven't seen the trailer, but now that you've mentioned it, I'm going to have to go seek that out.
Yeah, check it out. It's on the film stage, and it's a cool trailer. It gives you a really good sense of kind of the style of the film. And I think if you're a fan of Waltz with Bashir, and if you haven't seen that film, I definitely recommend you check it out. I'm sure The Congress will be on your radar whenever it gets a release later in the year.
And do you know, for most of these, if they have been picked up and if they will be?
I really, unfortunately, I don't have that information handy, but some of them have. I'm not sure if the Congress has been picked up, but I'm sure it will be. But yeah, we should try and get that information, actually. Jordan, where are you?
I was about to say, I'm sure as it comes out, we'll have it.
Yeah, I think we've tried to make note of some things. Like, I know, like, the Jarmusch got picked up. In Blue is the Warmest Color got picked up. So we have, like, some, but I'm not exactly sure when they're getting released and stuff. So,
all right.
Yeah.
And okay. What was the next one?
Next up, we have Asghar Farhadi's follow-up to his Oscar-winning Iranian film, A Separation, mm-hmm. which is The Past, which is kind of... to be honest, I have not seen A Separation, but from everyone I've talked to, it's basically... There's a lot of similarities going on. It's basically a little bit of a melodrama about a female in France who is... sends a message to her ex-husband who's been living in Iran to come back to France so that she can have a divorce with him because she's living with another younger guy and like she's living with his kids and then she's got other kids from another marriage. And so it's like all about like these like should we forget things from the past in order to like better our future? Can we forgive and forget kind of to make things better, or is it these things in the past? And it's just like he has such a very delicate style in the way he directs. It's very poetic and it's tragic, and you know, there's some really great scenes of like intense drama. And Berenice Bejo, who was the other lead in The Artist, which I think was 2 years ago, right?
I believe so, yes.
She ended up winning the Best Actress Award for this film, and I can totally see why, because it's a great performance. In fact, the entire ensemble of characters is really great. The actor from A Prophet is also in this, and I'm kind of blanking on his name right now, but he was excellent in it as well. Tahar Rahim, he was excellent in it as well. So yeah, excellent.
I was about to say that's two fantastic actors mixed with a director who directed one of the most talked about films of that year. So that sounds like a winner.
Have you seen The Separation, or are you like me? You haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it yet, which is weird.
It's on my like top of my must see list.
Yeah, but. And it's just one of those things, you know, getting the time to watch. And I'm a huge fan of Iranian cinema, oddly enough. So
oh yeah, yeah. I'm a big Kiarostami fan. Like I've seen pretty much all his films. I'm a big fan of his. But yeah, him and then the guy who's been arrested and on house arrest in Iran, his films, I forget his name, Jafar Pahini, I know I'm screwing that up, but yeah, Iranian cinema is really amazing stuff. Highly recommend if you're not familiar with it to try and explore and check some of that out.
Yeah, I took an Iranian cinema class
nice.
In college, and that was incredible. That was one of my favorite classes in college.
It's there's really great stuff there.
I was a journalism major, so I don't know why the hell I took
very nice, class. Very nice. Hey, I'm sure it's paying off right now. So.
Yeah, it is.
There you go.
All right, so take us to the next one.
Number three. So this film, Like Father, Like Son by Hirokazu Koreeda, a Japanese film, really got to me. It's really emotional, really heart-wrenching. Koreeda, who's known for his kind of like intimate style, his personal style of filmmaking, and often like, you know, really pulling on the heartstring type stuff. He made this film, Nobody Knows. Are you familiar with that one, about a group of kids that have no parents and they're like living in an apartment by themselves and trying to take care of themselves?
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah. He's a really great filmmaker, and you know, he mixes it up sometimes, but this is his kind of like stay put. And with this latest film, and it's really interesting and kind of makes you think premise, even though it's like kind of just unfortunate to have to think if this ever actually happened to someone. But the story is basically this family, they're well to do. They have this really cute 6-year-old boy. They're trying to get him into a nice elementary school. And the father, he's a little bit, it doesn't spend a lot of time with his kid because he works in an architecture firm, and you know, he doesn't have time, and he's trying to instill a really hard work ethic into his son because, you know, kind of Japanese societal norms to like work as much as you can. And they get a phone call one day that there was a tragic mix up at the hospital where their child was born, and the child they've been raising was actually not their son. And they got switched by accident at birth. So they come to this quandary where, like, now they have to decide, you know, do they switch their child who they've raised for 6 years with someone else's who is from a, you know, another family has raised their child. And so they meet the other family, and the other family is more of like a working class family, but they have two other kids and they're more of a family unit. And it's just really heartbreaking because, you know, like it's all about like them trading the kids and the kids have to, having to like understand what's going on, but they don't really understand. And, you know, the mothers don't want to give them up. And it's really poignant film about what it means to be a parent, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, and actually early on, I thought this was a contender for the Palme d'Or before seeing Blue is the Warmest Color, which is, we'll talk about that later. That is my favorite film of the fest.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a happy film on this list?
you know,
will there
Khan,
be a
is, Khan is not really known for the happy films.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, it's funny. The next film, Inside Llewyn Davis, I was going to say, oh, that's a great feel-good film, but it's actually Inside Llewyn Davis is all about a down-on-his-luck artist, and they play that down-on-the-luck element to the extreme with deadpan humor, and so even though it's a really funny film, it's kind of also a depressing film at the same time. So
that's the Coen Brothers.
keep Coen Brothers and keeping in line with the Khan streak that we've got going here. Yeah, that film, I mean, for anyone that's not familiar with the Coen Brothers, come on now, you need to get on board with them. And, you know, they're usually always making amazing films. And even their films that are not the greatest or, like, have issues, they're still better than most films, you know. And aside from just a few clunkers like, you know, Burn After Reading and Lady Killers, pretty much all their other films are pretty great. And this one is definitely one to add to that collection. It's actually probably the most straightforward film they've ever made. Like, there's not really, it's like a very straightforward, simple story about this singer that's kind of down on his luck and, you know, nothing he can never get, really seem to get anything going for him. Even though he's immensely talented as a musician. And, the look and the feel of this film, I mean, these brothers, I mean, these guys, they are master filmmakers working at the top of their game. And, you can just tell by watching the film, it just, every element of this film is so perfectly composed that it's a transportive experience where you really feel like you're in the time era of, 1960s during this folk scene in New York. And, really bittersweet, but also very funny. And, you know, any fan of the Coen Brothers will enjoy this film for sure.
Now, did I hear incorrectly? Did you not like Burn After Reading?
I am not a big fan of that one, no.
And yet somehow you left, what's it called? Intolerable Cruelty off of your list of failures.
Oh, yeah, I would put that one on there too.
Okay, all right. As long as that one is also on there.
Yeah, that would probably be before Burn After Reading. Burn After Reading did have some things that were okay, but it was still kind of a big mess.
All right.
I won't fight you on that one. You're a fan of that one?
Burn After Reading, I think, is unfairly slandered from time to time. But, I mean, it's funny because you put it next to
the... I just remember Frances McDormand's role in that just being way over the top. And
yeah,
like,
it was quite... I mean, like, everyone in that was
it was... Yeah, everything was kind of a little over the top. But yeah. There was some, like, cool... I remember there being some interesting scenes.
It just seemed odd to me that you would put that next to the Lady Killers, and yet you would somehow elide Intolerable Cruelty.
Intolerable Cruelty was the one I meant to put... But I think those three, I could do without.
Yeah, they're a trifecta of weaker efforts.
Yeah.
But still
love the Coen Brothers. They're awesome. Yeah. And Oscar Isaac in this movie is amazing. He's definitely going to get some Oscar love, I think, for sure. And Justin Timberlake, for those JT fans out there, is only really in two scenes. It's kind of a joke. And yeah. in both scenes, he's only singing. So so there you go. Keep it going, JT. And it was really funny. There was a joke because he was on the cover of Variety like the day after. And it said, yes, you can, JT, like with can. And
oh,
like,
God.
And everyone was making fun of it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about your number one.
Yeah,
and,
the most talked about film at the fest for sure. It just, you know, and originally what's funny is because of the runtime, it's a 3-hour film. Initially, a lot of people were like, oh, what, you know, 3-hour film. Like, you know, in Cannes, you can see two movies in 3 hours. So, like, you know, you have to budget that time wisely. So I actually chose to skip the initial screening of the film because I was like, all right, I'll wait to hear the buzz on this to see if I'll, you know, it's worth seeing. And everyone that had seen it was like, this is, you know, we got a Palme d'Or contender, Palme d'Or. This is the Palme d'Or. My flatmate, Jordan Hoffman, big shout out to him. He's a writer for film.com and a bunch of other outlets, but he's been writing reviews and he saw that first screening and he told me how amazing it was. And so I saw it the next day and sure enough, I mean, you can sometimes just tell when a film is like slightly a notch above the rest. Like to me, this happened with Amour last year and the year before that with Melancholia, where it's just like, to me, there's just a slight level of mastery that's amazing and affecting, and also controversial, because there is so, part of what makes this film so gets you in your face is the intimacy of it, and that means that the sex that happens in this film is very graphic and very intimate, but in a way that's tasteful and artful and really adds to the experience of knowing what's going on in the story. It's basically the story, just to give you a quick summary, is a young girl, 15 years old, in France, kind of going through high school, dates this, you know, popular boy in high school, but something is off, you know, when they have sex, she doesn't feel the desire for him. Then she meets this girl with blue hair, hence the color blue is the warmest color. And you know, they start like, you know, they start to fall in love, and it's basically, it documents their love from beginning to end. And it's a beautiful experience. It's very, very powerful, very intimate, and the performances are stunning. I mean, it's really amazing. To me, it kind of reminded me, the closest thing, stylistic, it's kind of like a Dardenne Brothers film, where it's like you have this very detached, we're just showing you kind of reality. And but in this, it's a beautiful and heartbreaking story at the same time, but very affecting, and definitely deserved to win the Palme, hands down. There really was no other contender after I saw that film. So
you lost me for a bit, but when you talked about the Dardenne brothers, I was back on board. Because I can very easily see how a story like that could be done poorly.
It's funny because, you know, I say 3 hours and the movie flies by because you're so engaged in what's going on. And especially with the lead actress, who is just a revelation. Let me get her name. She has a complicated... They actually changed the main character's name to Adele. In French, the title is La Vie d'Adèle, but we translated to Blue is the Warmest Color because that was kind of a pseudonym of the... It was based on a comic book. Well, actually, they call bande dessinée in France, these hardcover comics. Adèle Exarchopoulos, who is the main character, and then the other... lead Emma is played by Léa Seydoux, who's been in a few other films, like she was in Mission Impossible 4, and she's been in some other French films as well. But really amazing stuff. Highly recommend. I mean, I think Sundance Selects picked it up. Sundance Selects picked it up. So it'll be out later this year. I'm sure a lot of people will see it, and I'm interested to see if they're going to cut down some of those sex scenes, because it is almost like a 10-minute sex scene, and it's very graphic.
I mean, it's an interesting question, because I actually did see a lot of people on Twitter musing over that.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's done in a way that really does not feel like a creepy dude just watching them. It feels like an artful kind of way of expressing how passionate they are, and it really adds to the emotion you feel for like when things go bad and all that. So
I would feel really off put about all that if you hadn't brought up the Dardenne brothers,
right?
So hopefully that also eases the minds of some other people, because I hear, you know, drama about the woman, you know, discovering herself in 10-minute
long. It sounds almost a little cliche, but it's really not. It's very naturalistic. Think the Dardenne brothers. Like I can't think of a specific Dardenne brothers film, but that kind of style where it just feels like realist, and you're just showing life, and it's beautiful, and it's sad, but it's so affecting. It's epic. This film is epic. So yeah.
All right. Well, I'm interested, and I'm looking forward to being able to see it, hopefully in its full form.
Definitely. Yeah. So those are the top five.
And now let us talk about the ones that are slightly less than wonderful.
Yes, slightly less than wonderful. So I guess one of the big disappointments that was one of the big divisive films, was Only God Forgives, which I thought was all right, but was not, you know, it was an exercise in style versus substance. And, you know, if you're really into his style, you might really like the film. It's got it looks very cool. Ryan Gosling is cool in it, even though he barely speaks anything. And
so it's like his character from Drive.
He talks less than the character in Drive. And this movie has like barely any story, like unlike Drive. Everything in this movie is more about symbolism. And I think, you know, I think Refn was inspired by Jodorowsky, who he actually dedicates the film to. So he's trying to express more of cinema as art, but he's like kind of riffing on this Asian revenge style film, which is really what his whole film is about. His whole style of films is about. So it just feels like he's troping his own style, and there's just not enough meat there to really chew on. It's everything is kind of just like, oh, okay. It's a little too obvious. The action scenes, I mean, the big fight scenes or the moments of violence, they're cool, but they're not that great. The bad guy, he's cool. This Thai actor, but the whole movie moves very slow. Like everyone's like walking in slow motion for whatever reason, or they're just walking really slow. And the only person that actually feels like a real person is Kristen Scott Thomas, who she has some really great lines and she's really funny in the film. But like it's very vulgar and like I don't know. I understand why some people really hated it. I wasn't on that high side of fence. I was kind of in the middle, like kind of like it's all right.
You brought up Jodorowsky. Mm-hmm. Talking about that, there was also a movie there called
he had a big presence there. I mean, he was dedicated for Refn, but yeah, he had his first new film in 23 years called Danza de la Realidad, because mm-hmm. he hasn't made a film in 23 years. And then he had Jodorowsky's Dune, which he did not direct, but it's a film about the making of what could have been the most epic film ever, pretty much.
It's one of those films that kind of gets whispered about quite a bit.
Exactly, yeah. And
so I'm interested how it did.
I had never really heard of the whole story behind this. And basically what happened is after Jodorowsky, if you're unfamiliar, he made these two films, El Topo and The Holy Mountain, in the early 1970s that were kind of like the first midnight cult films. He had the opportunity to remake Frank Herbert's Dune into this epic sci-fi masterpiece that would have been like as big a scale as Star Wars at the time. And this was pre-Star Wars. And they had like Pink Floyd on board to do the soundtrack. They had Salvador Dali as to play the Galactic Emperor, Orson Welles as a villain. So you had all these crazy, David Carradine is one of the leads, and, you know, all these crazy, crazy elements. And what's really interesting is just the passion that Jodorowsky has for making film. So it reminded me a little bit like Lost in La Mancha, you know, the film that Terry Gilliam tried to make but never successfully made, except this is more just the pre-conceptual. And, like, what's amazing is Jodorowsky, like, basically made, like, a comic book storyboard, this, like, huge lookbook that he used to pitch to studios, and he has the entire film storyboarded out like a comic, and he basically goes through the whole story and the process he went through to try and make it and why ultimately it failed because, you know, no studios were willing to take a risk. But then what ended up happening is because, you know, that lookbook was so comprehensive, it ended up trickling down into other movies like Alien and Star Wars and other things like that. So it's very cool. It's a must-see for fans of, like, sci-fi and filmmakers and all that, yeah, definitely.
And so what about Danza de la Realidad?
Yeah, I mean, like, again, if you're familiar with Jodorowsky, it's a Jodorowsky film, you know. It's surreal, it's bizarre, it's about his personal life, it's about him when he was growing up as a kid in this harbor town in Chile that was near like a desert. And so it's very surreal and it's very bizarre. There's some scenes of graphic torture. There's some scenes that are pretty disturbing. There's a urination scene that makes the paperboy scene look like, you know, a children's TV show. but if you're a fan of him and like that kind of just over the top style, in many ways, it's like his Amarcord. It's like a very personal story. And, It's definitely surreal. And I don't know if that got picked up for release, but I'm sure it will, because there's enough fans of him that I think that there's a market there.
All right, excellent. Now, what about some of the bad movies? What were things that you out and out did not like?
Yeah, there was a few that I really did not like. Jimmy P, The Psychotherapy of a Plains Indian with Benicio Del Toro and Mathieu Almerac. That was just really just boring and dull. It was like Benicio Del Toro being like a Native American who had like a war injury, and he has like mental problems, and it's basically like The King's Speech, but like with this war veteran, and Benicio Del Toro trying to be an Indian, and then Mathieu Almerac is playing this over-the-top French psychoanalyst, and it just didn't work. And I was like, why would anyone want to make this movie? And no, that was kind of universally panned. Another big disappointment, which was a real bummer for me, because I'm a big fan of his work, is Takashi Miike's Shield of Straw.
Yeah, I saw that on the list, and I was kind of upset, because that was one of the top three that I was looking forward to.
Same here. I was really anticipated for it because I thought the premise just sounded great, and the premise is great. It's basically one of the richest, you know, billionaire tycoons in Japan. His granddaughter gets raped and murdered, and so he puts out like a $1 billion ransom on the killer's head, which basically turns anyone, like everyday citizens, into wanting to kill this guy. So he turns himself in to the cops, and then they have to like get him to a courthouse. But in the process, like everyone is trying to kill him, and you have like it's a kind of a moral action thriller where you have like cops and nurses and people you would never expect to try and kill someone, you know, turning against their morals for money. And then you have like this whole like people trying to get them, but it becomes another Takashi Miike overblown melodrama for the second, like for almost a good more than half of the film. The first 20 minutes are really great, and then everything after that is just, it's terrible, I thought. So
that's such a letdown.
And then some other ones, Blind Detective, Johnny To's new film, wasn't really a big fan of that. It was like he was trying to channel Stephen Chow's style of like, you know, Hong Kong live action comedy, but didn't really achieve it very well. I saw Last Day of Mars, which was in the director's fortnight, which I had the director who was supposed to do the Akira film after the brothers dropped out. But it's basically like a Prometheus, you know, space zombie on Mars kind of film. Just awful. Total genre. Okay. Cliche. Yeah. And Liev Schreiber. And it had an interesting cast, but like totally wasted. Totally wasted opportunity. Prometheus Light, I called it, or something like that.
He made that one short. Oh God, I can't remember the name, but it
I know
had,
what you're talking about. Yeah, but it was good. The Mechanical Bunny or something. Yeah, it's not that. That's not the name of it, but.
This was not a worthy feature.
No, I mean it's kind of Rurari Robinson. I'm trying to get the name of this short, but yeah, it was a little. It was definitely a disappointment. Definitely a big disappointment. I mean, you know, there was a cool feel special effects, but it was like every cliche. It was like Walking Dead in space. It's like, I've seen this before. Come on, guy. Do something original.
Ghost of Mars.
Yeah. Exactly. Worse than that. Way worse than that.
Wow, that's hard to imagine. Okay.
And then Grigri, which was this African movie about a dancer who has a limp leg from polio, and he kind of like uses the leg to whip it around when he's dancing. And the way he dances is very cool, but then they try and force feed this story that doesn't really work there. So avoid that one. I mean, I don't think that'll get released. And then just a few others I wanted to mention in the good side. That's the last of the bad, but a few other good ones. All Is Lost, the Robert Redford film from Margin Call director J.C. Chandor, which is basically a silent film but there's not really any dialogue. Robert Redford, it's like Castaway 2, but done right, done tastefully, where he's on a boat trying to survive. Really enjoyed that. Surprisingly, I didn't think I was going to really love that, but it's a great performance and very taut and kind of done with class and grace and some interesting themes there. Borgman, which was a big surprise in the main competition, kind of a melange of Kill List, Michael Haneke's Funny Games, and like Wicker Man, kind of a very weird, demonic, dark satire that takes an abstract horror premise and kind of you don't really never know what to expect. And we had a joke going that Spielberg was going to say, gotta go Borgman, even though clearly he was not. And then the last one was just, I wanted to mention, is the Jarmusch film, Only Lovers Left Alive, which really enjoyed that. Kind of like hipster vampires doing like all these like late night conversations because they've been living for so long, and they look like rock stars. And you know, it's a vampire movie, but it's a Jarmusch movie overall, you know, so right. It's not, they're not really concerned with the whole vampire tropes, which was really good. And then a few other good ones I'll quickly mention. Nebraska was really solid. Alexander Payne's black and white film. Emotional performances. I thought, you know, it had very mixed opinions from the critics at the fest, but I thought it was shot really well. It's shot on like black and white film, has a really cool grainy look, and Will Forte, the MacGruber, I mean, turns a great performance as a supporting actor, and the Bruce Dern, who was the main actor in that one, and the Best Actor Award. Paolo Sorrentino's La Gran Bellezza, which was like a modern-day Fellini film. You know, it was a little overindulgent in its style, but it was very unique. And just like, if you're into that kind of Italian over the top films with fashion and talking about existential things, it was really cool. Francois Ozon's Jeanne and Jolie, yeah. Which, you know, compared to Blue is the Warmest Color, they have a similar tone in that it's about these young women going through these sexual experiences. You know, Jeanne and Jolie, it's about a young girl who loses her virginity one summer and then decides to become a prostitute. I felt in Jeanne and Jolie, it was a little more forced the way they tried to explain things, and it was a little more exploitative than Blue is the Warmest Color, where Blue is the Warmest Color had a more sincere feel. But there's still some interesting things. Ozon is like, you know, he likes to play with like these themes of the young and the beautiful. So this is like distills that to the point. And the main actress was really good in it. So that was enjoyable.
What about The Immigrant? What I was going to ask about.
Immigrant, James Gray's, I think it's like his fourth or fifth film. You know, this one also had a really kind of big split. Some of my friends really thought this was like one of the best films in the fest, and then a few others really hated it. I was kind of in the middle. The cinematography by Darius Kanji is like hands down the best part of this film. You really feel like almost like it's like Godfather Part Two. You're back in that New York of the 1920s. You know, during this immigration thing in Ellis Island. The performances from Marion Cotillard, Joaquin Phoenix were solid. But, you know, it's a little bit cliched, the story, and some of the premise I thought was a little like, and it can be a little dull, but the ending is fantastic. It has one of the best endings of the fest. So it's a mixed bag for me, but I think some people will get a lot out of it. Especially if you're into that kind of period of history. I thought he did a really good job of kind of recreating that style. But like I said, it has its fair share of issues as well. So, yeah.
Two others that I wanted to ask about.
Sure.
Let me know if you saw them. A Touch of Sin.
A Touch of Sin, no. That was actually one of the films that I really wanted to see, the Jijinka film. But I missed it because I arrived like a day late. And wow. That won the Best Screenplay Award. And I was bummed. I really bummed that I missed that. It looked really cool. A lot of my friends had pretty positive things. A few said it wasn't as good as some others had said, but I was really looking forward to that. Yeah.
Yeah. That had made Danny and I's list. And so I was looking for some feedback on that.
Yeah, I know. The other one that I'm bummed I missed was Heli, because that ended up winning the Best Director Award. So I saw all the main competition films except four. Heli, Touch of Sin, Castle in Italy, and Michael Colas, the Mads Mikkelsen film, and two of them won awards, so great. But it's all good. It was still a great fest. So,
all right, the final one I wanted to ask about sure. was actually Nick's number one. It was Venus in Fur.
Okay,
the new Polanski film.
Yeah, I was a little bit mixed on this one. If you've seen his previous film Carnage, which was adapted from a play by Yasmina Reza. Carnage took place in one location, so it's kind of a very theatrical film. Venus in Fur takes that even further in that it actually takes place in a theater, and it's about an actress auditioning for a role with the intent of like kind of subverting his expectation. And the whole thing takes place in one scenario. And again, it's adapted from a play. So it's like, it's basically we're watching a little bit of a play on stage. I called it was like 50 Shades of Polanski because it plays with a lot of like S&M and bondage and domination kind of themes. I thought it was, you know, there's a lot to chew on there. It's all about the wordplay, but I'm kind of like, I'm a little tired of seeing him do this kind of one interior location films. He's such a talented filmmaker. I want to see him have a little more room to play with things and make a more vibrant, larger film, something a little more unexpected. But yeah, so I was a little bit mixed on that one.
Well, yeah, that's it for my. I mean,
yeah. We pretty much hit them all out. I mean,
you hit the highlights.
Behind the Candelabra, Steven Soderbergh's last film. I saw that one too.
Yeah, Michael aired on HBO.
On HBO, yeah. Michael Douglas gives a great performance, but overall, I was just like, it was all right. Yeah.
All right, and so that'll do it for now. For anyone who's interested in reading up more, you can find all of our coverage on the Film Stage at thefilmstage.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a ton of reviews courtesy of Rafi right here.
Yeah, definitely check all the reviews out. We're going to be having the best of roundup, which will have a nice links to everything you can check out. And be sure to follow me on Twitter, Zaffi, Z-A-F-F-I. You can check out my pictures on Instagram from the festival. I took a bunch of vines that are on my Twitter. And
we're starting to plug the vines now, eh?
You gotta plug the vines. I mean, I took some vines. I went to the Nebraska premiere, so you can see my experience going to that, and you can see some shots inside the theaters. I filmed the bumper, so I was vining like a madman. And the parties, got to go to the Hunger Games party, the We Are What We Are party. You know, living it up, French Riviera style.
Another thing to be jealous about. My thing about Vine is I love it, but I don't live an interesting enough life that I really feel like I have anything to Vine.
You can make anything interesting. I'll tell you that right now.
I guess. I'll have to exercise some more creativity. You all know where you can find me on the Film Stage at my personal website, dearfilm.net, and on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And I guess if you want to look for me on Vine, it's the same thing.
Fine.
Woo, Vine. But that's it for today. So, Rafi, thanks for joining us.
Yep, my pleasure.
We will look forward to hearing from you when you go again, invariably next year, and make us all
most
jealous
likely,
once again.
Most likely. We should try and get the whole team out there. You know, let's make all film stage descends on Con.
I would absolutely love to do that and do a live reportage from there and get
that would be amazing and like cover all the films like in every category. Yeah,
and then just have like a massive 10-hour SmackDown session.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's something to shoot for next year.
Definitely. All right, man.
It has been fun, and ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. And you will, I'm trying to command the audience. And you should check us out when we air our next episode next week. Not sure what the review will be, but it will be fun and interesting to listen to. You have that guarantee.